Good afternoon. My name is Susan, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the State of Communities of Color Report press call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you, Mrs. Anne Shoup. You may begin your conference.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our press call on the State of Communities of Color Report by the Center for American Progress and our project Progress 2050. Just a reminder that this call is being recorded, and by participating in the call, you consent to being recorded. The report can be found on the front page of our website, AmericanProgress.org, and if you'd like to contact any of our experts or have any questions about the report, you can contact my colleague Laura Perea at LPEREYRA at AmericanProgress.org. We're going to be hearing from three speakers today. Cy Richardson, Vice President of Housing and Community Development at the National Urban League, Catherine Singley, Senior Policy Analyst with the Economic and Employment Policy Project at the National Council of La Raza, and Dr. Christian Weller, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Dr. Weller is now going to walk us through the report.
Well, thank you very much, Anne. I should also add that I'm a professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Thank you very much for coming on the call today, this afternoon. And we are releasing this, I think, the fourth iteration of this report of the state of communities of color in the economy. This report, this year's version, was co-authored by Julia Jinkia, Jane Farrell, and myself. We wanted to highlight once again how communities of color are doing as the economy completes its third year of the economic recovery, and the fourth year is in its fifth year since the Great Recession. We specifically highlight data on African Americans, Asians, and Latinos in comparisons to white households and over time, specifically from 2007 to 2010 or 2011, depending on which data are the most recent ones. We present data on a wide range of economic security indicators. These include jobs, wages, health insurance coverages, income-related measures, but we also present data on household wealth, since savings in all of their forms tend to be a sign of economic security. We include data on total wealth, homeownership, and retirement savings in this report. The comprehensive data presentation in the report leads to two broad conclusions. The first one is that job creation remains a pressing issue for all groups, but it is of particular concern to African Americans. Economic security for most groups started to indeed improve after 2009, after it had deteriorated substantially during the recession from 2007 to 2009. But economic security tended to stay fairly low and showed very little signs of improvement for African Americans in 2010 and 2011. Let's take, for instance, the unemployment rate, which was lower at the end of 2011 than at the beginning of the recession and the recovery in June 2009 for all groups except for African Americans. The African American unemployment rate at the end of 2011 was 15.5% and thus above the 14.9% at the end of the recession in 2009. So the African-American unemployment rate was substantially higher, about twice as high than that of whites, but it also continued to rise while it was falling for all other groups. That leads me to the second broad conclusion, that is that communities of color generally tend to lag well behind whites in many key economic security indicators, often because they have less access to good jobs. African Americans, for instance, their median weekly earnings were $674 in the fourth quarter of 2011. Latinos' earnings were $549, while whites earned $744 each week at the same time. And the share of African Americans without health insurance in 2010, which is the most recent data we have available, was 20.8%. The respective share of Latinos without insurance coverage was 30.7%. This compares to 18.1% of Asian Americans without health insurance, but only 11.7% of whites without health insurance at the same time. We generally see lower unemployment rates, for instance, for Asian Americans, but we do see indicators of lower quality jobs among Asian Americans, such as lack of health insurance coverage and higher poverty rate. The important point is that these observations are not new. African Americans already did not benefit as much as other groups from the economic growth of the last business cycle that lasted from 2001 to 2007. And communities of color have experienced persistently less economic security than whites for decades. Historical experience also shows that recessions typically prove worse for communities of color than of whites. Their unemployment rates tend to rise faster and further and stay higher longer, as is the case in this instance in the current recovery for African Americans, than is the case for whites. The point is that our summary data summary does not highlight a new phenomenon, only illustrates that the crisis is much more severe, that the inequities are much wider and larger than they have been in the past because of the severity of the crisis. That means that communities of color can ill afford for policymakers to dither again on identifying and implementing targeted policies that will start to shrink some of these existing inequities. The important point here is that policymakers need to continue to emphasize economic growth and job creation, but they also need to develop targeted policies to start to address these persistent inequities. The continued lack of strong job opportunities for African Americans deserves policymakers' attention. That could be addressed through infrastructure investments in roads, transportation, and schools, which would help to boost economic growth and job creation, especially among communities of color. Similarly, support to state and local governments tend to offer disproportionate jobs benefits for African Americans because African Americans tend to disproportionately be represented in the employment of state and local governments. The other point that also needs to be addressed is the persistent inequities in economic securities, regardless of which measures we indicate, need to be addressed through policies. We highlight a number of policy measures in the report that could begin to shrink the existing inequities. These include higher minimum wages, stronger unemployment insurance, better workforce development mechanisms to ensure that communities of color find more pathways to high-quality jobs. Our data summary shows large and consistent inequities by race and economic security, by race and ethnicity when it comes to economic security. The data, in fact, suggests that some inequities may have grown worse during the crisis and the subsequent recovery. The U.S. population, however, is growing more diverse, and persistent inequities are holding back an ever larger share of the population. The data should thus, create a sense of urgency for policymakers to address these inequities and create pathways for communities of color forward. Thank you very much.
Cy, can we hear from you next?
Yes, thank you. Well, I mean, the data is certainly sobering, yet not all too surprising. I mean, I think it does, however, underscore what we're seeing and learning vis-a-vis the racial wealth divide. And for me, that's the coda, if you will, of this data compilation analysis. And it's reflected most starkly with the fact that the wealth gap between white and African-American families has more than quadrupled over the course of a generation. And I'll also say that as wealth building and asset preservation is at the heart of the National Urban League's theory of change under our economic empowerment programming and advocacy rubric, there's no part of this update that is uninteresting and unrelated to our work. Just a little bit of an overview. As you know, wealth, what you own minus what you owe, allows people to start a business, buy a home, and send children to college and ensures an economically secure retirement. But without wealth, families and communities cannot become and remain economically secure, obviously. Recognizing the importance of building wealth over a lifetime, our nation has created public policies that provide incentives and subsidies for asset-building activities. However, our argument is that reforms are needed to ensure that such opportunities and rewards are distributed equitably. The racial wealth gap results, as we understand it, from historical and contemporary factors, but the disturbing recent increases, as Christian laid out, in such a short time period reflects public policies such as tax cuts on investment income and inheritances, which do benefit the wealthiest and redistribute wealth and opportunities. Tax deductions for home mortgages, retirement accounts, and college savings all disproportionately benefit higher-income families. And at the same time, evidence from multiple sources demonstrates the powerful role of persistent discrimination in housing, credit, and labor markets as well. I mean, for example, African Americans and Hispanics were at least twice as likely to receive high-cost home mortgages as whites with similar incomes. And these reckless high-cost loans unnecessarily impeded wealth building in minority communities and triggered the foreclosure crisis that's wiping out the largest source of wealth for minorities in the history of the country. Just want to talk for a minute about the intersection of credit and debt in the African-American community as related to this discussion. And we believe that this area holds significant promise with regard to future policy formation. The increase in negative wealth experienced by many black households at the lowest positions on the totem pole, as it were, reveals a new dependence on credit to make ends meet. Among those with no financial assets, credit is often an emergency resource. And in terms of why people of color rely on credit, the growth of debt comes after years of deregulation of the lending market. I mean, the segmentation of the mortgage lending market highlights a general trend in lending in which low-income people and consumers of color pay more for accessing credit. And in credit-starved minority communities across the country, and my colleagues on the call know this very well, the deregulated market brought a proliferation of high-cost lending, including securitized subprime and predatory loans, payday lending and check cashing stores, et cetera. And with greater numbers of families struggling with ever-growing debt that far outstrips their income and savings, many low-income and minority households must turn invariably to costly lending products because they have no other options. Minorities and low-income consumers resort more frequently to credit card debt and other forms of high-cost debt in the absence of assets. However, and notwithstanding these realities, we firmly believe a family's connection to the financial mainstream determines whether they have access to safe and affordable financial products or instead rely on high-cost fringe financial services that can strip income and wealth from them. Finally, just a word about how we move forward and the role policy has in that progression. We believe public policy can play a critical role in shaping financial security and opportunity. And this country has a long history of subsidizing asset and wealth building from the Homestead Act and GI bills, the creation of the 30-year mortgage and the mortgage interest deduction. The problem is that these policies have been unevenly applied and inconsistently championed, and we're going through such a phase at the moment in the whole housing finance reform debate we've all read about. The massive question, therefore, for policymakers, researchers like Christian and others, and advocates like the Urban League and NCLR, is to what extent policy decisions actually change the lives of individuals and families. For me, the CAP study strongly suggests that we've got a lot of work yet to do, particularly for the folks my organization most cares about and works for. Thanks very much.
Catherine?
Good afternoon. This is Catherine Singley from the National Council of La Raza. We are the largest national Latino civil rights and advocacy organization in the United States. Thanks for having me on the call, and thank you to Christian and the entire CAP team for the excellent research report that really sheds a light on what we already know is true, but that doesn't get enough attention in the public policy debate today and in the media today. So I commend you for producing the report. It's no surprise from the data that we see here that Latinos, like all Americans, place the economy and particularly jobs as their top priorities going into this election year. Latinos in public opinion polls, and in communities as we talk to them one-on-one feel like they've been walloped. But we also know that there's traditional support in the Hispanic community for the role of government and the role of public policy in improving quality of life. So when we see data like this, we know that it's a reality that many people are living out day to day. And people are looking to public policymakers who are willing to act to, number one, create good jobs, and number two, to make sure people are prepared to compete for those jobs. As Christian pointed out, there's a little bit of a difference between, or there's a significant difference between how the recession has treated, how the recovery has treated African Americans and Latinos. There is some improvement in the employment picture for Hispanic workers when you just look at the national trends. But I want to put a big caveat on that, and that's first that at the state level, that's not necessarily true, and at the local level, there are still some regions and places that are hurting tremendously. Rhode Island, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, those are the top states for Latino unemployment that's close to 20%. So we're not out of the woods. And the second point on the jobs picture for Hispanics is that the kinds of jobs, the quality of jobs that Latinos are getting are worrisome, are not good in a lot of cases. We are seeing people go back into low-wage sectors where they're not protected, where they're vulnerable, where they may or may not get paid a full day's work, where they don't have access to benefits, as is borne out by the data in the report. So as the Latino vote has increased tremendously and in every state, there's no question that jobs is top of mind as people go into this year and hold their members of Congress and their elected officials accountable. And there's no question that there's been disappointment from the public on the lack of responsiveness in Washington to the ongoing jobs crisis. And while not many people are expecting significant progress in Congress before the election on jobs, I want to talk about two policies that are pending in Congress that could definitely influence voters' perceptions of the economy heading into the election. The first is transportation and infrastructure, and the second is a more ideological debate about job training and education. That's the piece about preparing workers to compete for jobs. So on transportation policy, as you may know, the federal government finances half or more of the capital investments to build, maintain, and improve roads, bridges, railways, and other modes of transportation systems, with a match from state and local governments. Right now, we're running on a short-term agreement to continue to fund these very vital services. But what we really need and what Congress is debating when they return in a couple of weeks is a reauthorization of the federal transportation policy. Transportation policy is essential to creating jobs and about a million direct jobs for Latinos. That means about a million Latinos work in the transportation sector. Transportation also gets people to work, to school, to healthcare, et cetera. That makes transportation reauthorization really essential to getting our economic recovery off the ground and solidly in becoming a reality in people's lives. We need Congress to work together to pass a bipartisan bill that allows states and localities to plan projects, to hire workers, and to make improvements that connect people to jobs and to opportunity. So that's one opportunity that Congress has to deal with when it returns and before the election that could have a significant impact right away in local communities to creating jobs and improving access to jobs. The second, workforce development, job training, and adult education, is a more ideological debate than a policy debate, and it's playing out right now in the halls of Congress, and people are watching. It sends important signals about how our elected officials value education and training moving forward. It sends a message about what the future American workforce will look like. I'm talking about exactly the skills gap and how to close it. The skills gap explains some, but not all, of the unemployment woes of some Latino workers. So on the one hand, we have a problem that we don't have enough jobs to go around. We have about 4 unemployed workers to 1 job opening. But there's also the issue that many people don't have the skills and education they need to compete for job openings. Latinos in particular are at a competitive disadvantage. About a third of Latino adults in today's workforce do not have a high school degree. In just a few years, by the year 2018, it's estimated that only 10% of the jobs in this country will be open to workers with less than a high school degree. 10% of the jobs open to people with less than a high school degree. That leaves employers without workers, and that leaves workers unemployed. This is a tragedy at the national level if we do not address it with public policy. There are those in Congress right now who say job training is a public good, just like public education and just like good roads. We need to get in the classrooms with adults, meet them where they are, meet workers where they are, and get them skilled up. There are others who say, let's take a short-sighted one-room classroom approach to save money, and they're ignoring our country's severe long-term worker preparation challenges. So Latino voters and Latino workers are watching these debates closely, and ultimately the bottom line is that our economy relies on the strength of the Latino workforce. Increasingly, Latinos make up a larger share of our workforce, and our economic prosperity. By 2050, which is the name of the project that CAP is spearheading, one in three American workers will be Latino. And that's not too far away. And the public policies that we enact today will make a big difference in whether those workers are prepared to compete on a global scale and keep American prosperity strong. Thank you.
Okay, can we open the line for questions?
Certainly. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and the number one on your telephone keypad. That's star and the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Juan Esparza with Vida en el Valle.
Yes, this is for Catherine. I just need a clarification. When you said only 10% of the jobs will be open to workers with less than a high school degree by, what year was that?
That's projected to 2018.
2018, okay.
In just 6 years, yes.
Okay. Now, my question is, in the Latino community, there's a lot of immigrants that fill jobs. I know that with the recession, there were a lot of undocumented that did go back to their home country rather than stay here because they had no jobs. Now, with the economy improving somewhat, I know that the remittances that have been sent back to countries like Mexico has been on the increase. What about that immigrant community that fills those jobs that Americans don't want? Is that still going to be a job situation is going to remain in the future, or is it going to be like disappearing, or where do the undocumented workers fit into the future growth, economic growth of this country?
Thank you for your question. There are a couple things to keep in mind. When we talk about the shifting makeup of American industries, certainly the service sector for the past couple of decades has become a major portion of what drives the American economy. And we do find a significant number of Latinos and immigrant workers in service sector jobs. So that's everything from food service, which continues to add jobs month after month, to health care, to building contractors, to construction. There's no question Latinos are making significant contributions to those industries. But those industries themselves are changing as well, and the educational and skills requirements in those industries is also rising. Some of that has to do with increased technology, and some of it just has to do with global competition and the need for people to have higher skills for communication on a daily basis, to communicate overseas, but also to get their work done here. I always think of the example of a delivery person who carries around a small computer with them to check off boxes and packages that person is delivering. That computer wasn't always part of that person's, that occupational requirement, if we look back historically, but that's an example of how technology is changing the skills and education requirements of the jobs that we have. We don't track the question on remittances. We don't track remittances here at NCLR. I would refer you to the Pew Hispanic Center for data on what's happening with those with remittances and with immigration flows related to the recession. But I do want to make a comment on the recent anti-immigrant laws in the Southeast, particularly in Alabama and Mississippi. And what we're seeing is employers coming out publicly in opposition of laws that make it a crime to be undocumented and to be working in that state because so many industries depend on workers coming into agriculture, the auto industry, et cetera, where we see immigrants making tremendous contributions. Those industries would not be able to survive without Latino workers. And I would refer you to NCLR's website to look at some of what happened over the past few weeks just in Alabama with the automakers and their statements about the economy of Alabama.
This is Christian. I want to jump in here very quickly and reiterate some of the stuff that Catherine said. But I just simply on the issue of undocumented immigrants, I think it would be a very sad statement for the U.S. economy if the only way the U.S. economy can do well is by super exploiting desperate workers. So I think immigration policy, comprehensive immigration policy, has to be part and parcel of an overall policy agenda to create pathways for economic mobility for communities of color in the country. And we can do it. We can afford it. I think it's the right thing to do. Employers want it. And the country needs it. So I think the issue here is not to say, like, okay, well, we need undocumented immigrants or the country needs them. That's, I think, a fallacy. I think the issue here is to create real pathways for people, undocumented immigrants, into legal immigration status, and create pathways of upward economic mobility for all communities of color, for all communities. That includes a whole host of policies, but they do have to be targeted to individual communities. And I think policymakers need to address this in a serious fashion, because I've done this number of years now, these reports, but I know others have been following this much longer, and it is a head-scratcher to wonder how policymakers cannot feel a sense of urgency at these numbers, and as the communities of color are making up a growing proportion of the U.S. population.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Antoinetta Cadiz with La Opinion.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. If we don't see new target policies for communities of color, how do you see the short-term future for this group, mainly for Latinos, while the country continues its recovery?
Well, I think the short-term outlook is bleak unless policymakers really start to find a sense of urgency here. And you really have to sort of look at the communities differently. Latinos have seen some gains in the labor market, but what we saw previously, especially in the years from 2000, 2001 to 2007, where we saw relatively strong employment gains in the Latino community, is that many of these jobs were still moderate wage jobs that didn't carry health insurance, that didn't come with pensions, that didn't come with enough money to for people to save. And what that means is that Latinos in particular are then left with an incredible sense of economic insecurity, even though they're working hard and they're doing the right thing. For African Americans, the story is somewhat different here, because the labor market, due to a lack of opportunities in key industries, manufacturing, public sector, and others, has really bypassed the African-American community for more than a decade at this point. And that has translated into, again, a tremendous sense of economic insecurity, declining homeownership rates, depletion of assets, as I mentioned, and other things. And then you look at parts of the Asian-American communities, you see high poverty rates, lack of good jobs. There are things that can be easily done. I mean, our report shows also a rapid rise in the number of people who are working at or below the minimum wage, for instance, in restaurants and agriculture, in the recovery. So I think raising the minimum wage, protecting workers, enforcing existing laws, but also investing in a workforce development infrastructure, as Catherine mentioned, and giving and rethinking the way we, through policy, help people build wealth, housing, retirement savings, and other forms. I think those are, they're all on the table. They all enjoy and often bipartisan support. And then I think there's a lot of things we can do relatively quickly. But without that, even if we see economic growth, even if we see continued labor market recovery, we're going to see continued desperation, massive economic insecurity, especially among communities of color, for years to come.
Yeah. This is Cy. I'd just like to add to that and just introduce a kind of generational dimension to the discussion. I mean, I think we need kind of targeted jobs and employment tactics and strategies. For example, and as I mentioned, from a generational standpoint, The unemployment rate for African-American youth is over 40%. But the employment population ratio makes clear the desperate situation faced by many urban youth. I mean, since the late 90s, the number has declined from a high of 33% down to 15%. And the labor force participation for African-American youth is now at a record low of 26%. I mean, we think a critical factor in eliminating racial and socioeconomic disparities in unemployment is providing a solid foundation upon which minority youth can build positive future labor market expectations and experiences.
Thank you.
Again, to ask an audio question, please press star and the number one on your telephone keypad. That's star and the number one on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from the line of Juan Esparza with Vida and El Bell.
This is a follow-up question. What does this mean as far as down the road when these people start facing retirement? I would imagine that if you don't have much personal assets, you will be rely on what, the public, the private groups to for your retirement age. Can anyone talk about that? Because, you know, that's something that a lot of people are starting to think about is retirement. And, you know, we're looking at Social Security maybe not being able to deliver 100% of what workers are being told now. And also the undocumented, I mean, they obviously are not are not eligible for public benefits such as Social Security. So is this something that that needs to be addressed now to prevent something worse happening down the road?
Well, I mean, we are looking at a worsening retirement crisis. More and more people expected not to maintain their standard of living in retirement, meaning they'll have to make substantial cutbacks in their spending. They're going to face substantial economic hardships, meaning they won't be able to stay in their homes, they won't be able to repair their homes, they won't be able to pay their heating bills, they won't be able to go to the doctor, they won't be able to pay for the medical bills, they won't be able to have three square meals a day, and so on and so forth. And at this point, the estimates are that over 50% of the population are not able to maintain their standard of living in retirement. And then those shares are substantially larger for communities of color because when you look at the numbers, there's a twofold answer here. We document the discrepancies in retirement security and retirement plan coverage at work. Latinos in particular are much less likely than African Americans or whites to have a retirement plan at work. But even whites who have a higher chance of having a retirement plan at work have about a 50% chance of being participating in retirement plan at work, which is higher than for African Americans or for Latinos. And that's just the private retirement savings. So a lot of people are, even if people have retirement plans, communities of color tend to have much less in retirement savings than whites, especially since they often are stuck in low-paid jobs and thereby have fewer abilities to save. So there is this lingering and sort of pushing a lingering problem that's sort of kind of pushing the problem, kicking the can down the road, that economic insecurity today translates into massive retirement insecurity in the future. It also translates into a problem on the public side. Social Security is structured in a way that it provides basic income insurance. It really is just a basic income insurance. Lower-income workers do tend to get a little bit more out of the system relative to how much they're paying in than higher-income earners. So as we are growing the share of low-income workers, moderate-income workers, as we're not addressing the economic security insecurity challenges among communities of color, we're actually creating a problem for Social Security that worsens its financial outlook over the long term. I don't think there's any proposal that really would take away benefits from low and moderate income workers in a Social Security reform idea, but the demands on Social Security will rise unless we address the economic insecurity challenges today. And it really requires both a strategy on the labor market side as well as on just in terms of job creation, but it really requires an addition, a rethinking of how we do retirement savings through tax incentives, how we make sure that more people get access to savings, how we reward people for savings through tax restructured tax incentives, and so on and so forth.
Just a point on data on Social Security and Latinos. For half of Latino seniors today, at least 90% of their income comes from Social Security. So they are particularly vulnerable to across-the-board cuts, which some in Congress are proposing.
And what is the when you say 90% of the income comes from Social Security of Latino half of Latino seniors, what does that compare for to the general population and also the other communities of color?
I don't have that in front of me. I'm sorry.
Okay.
It is the highest dependency rate, but also I should mention that even though there's a progressive formula to favor low-wage workers, Hispanic seniors have the lowest average benefits because they have lower lifetime earnings overall, which goes back to Christian's point about both the Social Security base, but also the benefits to which you're entitled later in life.
Okay, and to make sure that I understood what Christian was talking about and what you're talking about also, Christine, is that if it's obvious that the more the low income people, the better they do at work, the better they're able to pay for their own costs, for whether it's health insurance, buy a home, retirement, so on, the future of Social Security would be better because they are contributing, they'd be contributing a lot more rather than currently because they're low income, they're not really putting that much into the system.
Yeah, I mean, like the best way to highlight this is if you look back at the data for the late 1990s when we had a really strong and broadly strong labor market experience that was broadly shared that really raised wages and employment and benefits for all groups. During that period, just in a five-year period, the outlook for Social Security improved by 12 years, meaning like the date by which Social Security would ultimately face a financial shortfall was pushed into the future by 12 years. So a strong labor market that really lifts all boats can help Social Security. Shrinking income inequality, creating economic opportunities, creating a strong access to good job opportunities is ultimately a boon for Social Security.
Unfortunately, we don't have any more time for further questions, so I would like to thank our speakers for joining the call. If you would like to ask a follow-up question, you can contact my colleague Laura Perea at LPEREYRA@AmericanProgress.org. Thanks for joining us.
This does conclude today's conference. You may now disconnect.